Welcome to this special edition of the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler. As part of the OncView video series, Cancer Network spoke with Mark Szczesinski of the Advent Health Cancer Institute in Orlando, Florida, about updates in the management of extensive stage small cell lung cancer. Szczesinski touched on a number of important aspects of treating this disease, including the existing standards of care, treatment challenges, immunotherapy, and a ton more.
So, Dr. Szczesinski, how common is small cell lung cancer?
It's estimated to be about 13% of all lung cancers that we see in the United States. That translates into about 30,000 cases in the U.S. on an annual basis. So it's not as common as it used to be. In former decades, going back to the 1980s or so, it comprised 20 to 25%. But we've seen a decrease largely because of a decrease in smoking rates.
Okay. And I know you just mentioned smoking. What are the risk factors for small cell lung cancer?
Principally smoking. I mean, it's a very smoking-linked disease. 98% plus of patients have a significant smoking history. Other than smoking, we know that there can be certain occupational exposures that increase the risk. Radon is a risk. Family history is a risk. These sorts of things. But primarily in day-to-day practice, it really is a smoking-related cancer.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And what are the stages of small cell lung cancer? And with that, what is the typical course of progression?
You know, we should be thinking of small cell lung cancer in the TNNM system like we normally do, and the management based on TNNM probably shouldn't be that much different than its more common partner, non-small cell lung cancer. However, based on the implications for radiation therapy, we've kind of lapsed into what we refer to as limited stage versus extensive stage. Now, limited stage is defined as disease that can be contained within a reasonable and tolerable radiation port. And if, you know, our technology over the years in radiation therapy has improved such that, you know, that definition has been a bit of a moving target, so to speak. It turns out that only probably about 25 to 30% of cases fall into that limited stage category. At least two-thirds to 70% or so really are extensive stage disease. And extensive stage disease is simply defined as beyond limited stage. You know, if you have a malignant pleural effusion, a malignant pericardial effusion, that would be evidence of extensive stage disease. More typically, patients present with bone metastases, liver metastases, adrenal, brain metastases, these sorts of things in extensive stage disease. And that's really the typical progression of this disease.
Okay. And what is the prognosis for patients with small cell lung cancer? And what are the known prognostic factors?
The prognosis untreated, and you go way back to the 1960s when we didn't really have treatment, this was a rapidly fatal disease. You know, limited stage disease had a median survival of 3 to 4 months, extensive stage disease in the 6 to 8 week range. So it's a highly aggressive disease if it's untreated. Nowadays, you know, we do differentiate in limited stage disease that that's potentially curable. So that's our goal. In extensive stage disease, you know, we've seen an improvement with treatment up to that. The median survival nowadays is measured at about a year, and there are even some two-year survivors in the range of 20%+ or so, which was unheard of before we developed effective therapy. Some of the known prognostic factors, obviously, performance status is a known prognostic factor, high LDH levels, extensive stage disease, the more sites of metastases and more bulky disease. Certainly comorbidities can sometimes be limiting and alter the prognosis of patients because they have other illnesses that are, you know, linked to smoking and that sort of thing. So it's a complex group of patients.
Right. And so what makes small cell lung cancer so difficult to treat?
You know, it's interesting, when I trained years ago, small cell, we used to refer to as the chemotherapy and radiation sensitive cancers. And certainly we do see high response rates, but it quickly develops resistance to disease relatively soon. And I think it's because, you know, this is a tumor that has lots of mutations. Many of the mutations are in tumor suppressor genes. And it's just a rapidly resistant tumor to our current therapies that we use. So even though we've considered it sensitive to treatment, it rapidly develops resistance. And I think it's largely because of the makeup of the molecular nature of the disease being characterized mostly by tumor suppressor gene alterations.
Dr. Sosinski, what is the standard of care for small cell lung cancer at various stages of the disease?
So in limited stage disease, the standard of care is concurrent chemoradiotherapy. This is a stage of disease that I almost always routinely use cisplatin plus etoposide with radiotherapy. We can debate the optimal radiotherapy strategy. I like the BID and a shortened course approach, although some radiation oncologists prefer once daily treatments. I think the data suggests from a couple of clinical trials that that BID approach may be superior, but it certainly does have some logistical challenges. As I mentioned previously, we consider limited stage disease as potentially curable, mm-hmm. and we probably cure about 25 to 30% of these patients. In extensive stage disease, we don't consider it curable. Certainly, we'll talk a little bit about, as time goes on here, the standard of care, which for the past several decades has really not evolved until the immunotherapy era. Formerly, it was basically platinum plus etoposide. There didn't appear to be any difference between using cisplatin or carboplatin in phase three trials. It's estimated that there have been well over 30 phase three trials looking at new ideas in extensive stage small cell done over the past couple of decades, and none of them have really changed that standard of care. So it's remained a platform of platinum etoposide in extensive stage disease, and the expectation is that the median survival is, you know, hovers just north or south of 10 months. The 1 year survival hovers just north or south of about 40%. The 2 year survival is typically less than 15%. So that's kind of been where we've been over the past couple of decades.
Okay. And so I know you mentioned where we've been over the past few decades, but how have treatment options evolved over the past 10 or 20 years?
Well, from a chemotherapy point of view, you know, again, I would argue that they really haven't evolved that much. You know, we've been kind of stuck with the platinum etoposide, and really the recent evolution or revolution, if you call it, has been integration of immunotherapy in this setting. So, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but that's kind of been the significant change in the standard of care, but that's really only been over the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what have we learned about predictive factors for treatment response? Like, for example, does biomarker testing play a role in the treatment decision-making today?
You know, unfortunately, we don't really have any predictive markers for treatment response, and we don't really do any significant biomarker testing. Not even PD-L1 testing is routinely done. As I mentioned before, this is a disease in which there are no targetable oncogenic driver alterations. Again, most of the alterations are in tumor suppressor genes, which are difficult, if not impossible, to target. So there's been really a paucity and a lack of biomarker availability and biomarker usefulness in this particular setting, and we still don't really have good predictive factors for who's going to respond well and who's not.
So, Dr. Sosinski, how is extensive stage small cell lung cancer defined, and how does it differ from metastatic small cell lung cancer?
It really doesn't differ from metastatic small cell lung cancer. Again, as I mentioned previously, we should be thinking of this in the context of the TNNM staging system. Extensive stage small cell lung cancer would essentially be stage 4 disease, and that really is kind of equated to the term metastatic, if you will. Again, extensive stage disease is disease that is beyond a reasonable radiation port. It can include a malignant pleural effusion. It can include liver metastases or brain metastases or bone metastases, these sorts of things. So I kind of look at the terms extensive stage small cell, metastatic small cell, stage four small cell, as all kind of meaning the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what percentage of patients first present with extensive stage small cell lung cancer?
Unfortunately, it's about 70% or so. So it is the majority of patients. Again, as I mentioned before, this is an aggressive disease clinically. And so many of these patients, their first presentation is a hospitalization because they have some complication of their treatment. They're sick, they get into the hospital, and they're discovered to have extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So it is the majority of patients presenting with extensive stage disease.
Right. And what are some of the challenges that are specific to treating extensive stage small cell lung cancer?
As I mentioned, you know, this is a very smoking related disease. The median age of this population is about 70 years. If you combine smoking in elderly age, you get a whole bunch of comorbidities that are associated with this. People have COPD, cardiac disease, atherosclerotic disease, sometimes cerebrovascular disease, diabetes, other kind of diseases that go along with an older population. And that really makes it difficult. And then again, now that 70% of patients are presenting with extensive stage disease, there are implications with regard to performance status. These patients get sick. And it's difficult for them. So performance status is often an issue. So the complexity of managing the comorbidities, a declining performance status, disease-related symptoms, complications of the disease. Also, I haven't pointed out yet, but this is a disease in which there are a high number of paraneoplastic syndromes. Mm-hmm. A syndrome of inappropriate ADH is a common one. You can develop Cushing's disease. There are a number of neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes that can occur with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So those can be quite challenging. And we see them in small cell lung cancer where we typically don't see them that often in non-small cell lung cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what is the prognosis for patients at this stage of the disease?
The expectation from our old standard of platinum-based therapies is a median survival of about 10 months. Response rates would typically be in the 60 to 70% range. The median progression-free survival would typically be about 4 to 5 months. And the one-year survival typically in the phase three trials that have been done over the past decade is either just above or just below 40%. So most people do unfortunately die of this disease in the first year after diagnosis. And as I previously mentioned, the with platinum-based doublets, the two-year survival is typically less than 15%.
Okay. And so to kind of bring it all together, what are the unmet needs in this patient population?
Really, it's developing more effective therapy. And it's been a challenge, again, because of the complex molecular nature of this disease and it being a very refractory disease. You know, we've been kind of stuck in the platinum doublet standard of care for a couple of decades, and really nothing has changed that until we begin incorporating immunotherapy into first-line treatment.
Dr. Sosinski, what have been the response rates with standard of care frontline therapies in patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer?
The response rates to platinum-based doublets have typically been in the 60 to 70% range. Most of those are partial responses. Maybe 10% of them might be a complete response, but that's really been our expectation with standard of care platinum-based doublets, specifically platinum etoposide.
Okay, and what is the rationale for adding immunotherapy in this setting?
One of the factors that seems to be predictive of a benefit from immunotherapy in lung cancer has been a history of smoking. As we've established, this is a very smoking-related disease. So, and when you look at tumor mutation burden, which we also think is related to the effectiveness or potentially related to the effectiveness of immunotherapy, that these patients have a very high tumor mutation burden. Like other tumors where immunotherapy has been successful, melanoma, bladder cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, small cell would fit into that category. So that really is the underlying rationale for in thinking about adding IO in this setting.
Right. And so which patients would be eligible for immunotherapy in the frontline? And does PD-L1 status matter?
The trials that have been done have been kind of agnostic to PD-L1. PD-L1 is a bit difficult to measure in small cell lung cancer because of the nature of many of the specimens that we get there. So the eligibility for IO up front in these patients really has to do with, do they have any comorbid illnesses that would exclude them from immunotherapy? Do they have any interstitial lung disease, autoimmune diseases, other things that would make IO a contraindication? Most people don't have those. And so most people are candidates and eligible for IO in the first line setting. But we don't routinely do PD-L1 staining in this particular setting. We're not quite sure it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so has the withdrawal of the pembrolizumab indication for metastatic small cell lung cancer affected treatment options for the extensive stage small cell lung cancer population?
You know, it's an interesting question. We've seen both pembrolizumab as well as nivolumab, which were both indicated in third line treatment of extensive stage small cell lung cancer. That data was generated prior to the routine use of immunotherapy with first line treatment. So I don't think the withdrawal of those indications really alters the treatment options, because I think IO should be used first line, not third line. So I don't think that really has made a difference in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, great. And so I know we just mentioned pembrolizumab and nivolumab, but what other immunotherapies have been used or tried in this patient population?
Well, you know, all the, what I would call all the big four, atezolizumab, durvalumab, pembrolizumab, and nivolumab have all been tested, all of them in phase three, except for nivolumab. Nivolumab was in a very large phase two done there. And it's been interesting that the results of all of these trials have been very similar, very consistent, which is reassuring. Not all the trials have been statistically positive, but the impact of adding IO has been pretty consistent across these trials. So there's actually quite a wealth of information about IO therapy in the first line setting.
Now we're going to switch to the EMPOWER 133 trial. What was the design of the study and what kind of patients were included?
EMPOWER 133 was very simple design. It took the standard of care regimen of carboplatin and etoposide as the control arm. It was placebo controlled, and it gave four cycles of treatment, which is my standard. Followed by placebo maintenance. The investigational arm simply added atezolizumab to the combination of carboplatin and etoposide, and it continued atezolizumab as maintenance therapy. It was done in previously untreated extensive stage small cell lung cancer patients. They had to have an ECOG performance status of 0 to 1. I think was reflective of the types of patients that we see in clinical practice on a week by week basis in our practices.
Okay. And what were the findings on the key efficacy endpoint?
The key efficacy endpoint of interest is overall survival. So there was a clear benefit, the median survival, which is not an endpoint that I put a lot of emphasis on, was improved from approximately 10.3 months to 12.3 months. So about 2 months difference in favor of adding the atezolizumab. More importantly, the hazard ratio for overall survival was 0.7, so about a 30% reduction in the risk of death over time. there was about a 1 month difference in progression-free survival with a very similar hazard ratio. I believe it was 0.77. Interestingly, there was really no significant difference in overall objective response rate. They were both around 60 to 65%, but that's what we would think would be the going rate in this particular setting. So those were the key efficacy endpoints. You know, we also have some longer follow-up with two-year survival, where the two-year survival with the atezolizumab did exceed 20% in that trial. So I think that these are important observations from MinPower 133, and it led to the FDA approval of this agent and led to this being incorporated into the NCCN guidelines as well as other guidelines and pathways. So it was a critically important trial and did change the standard of care in extensive stage small cell lung cancer.
Absolutely. And similarly, what were the safety findings?
No surprises, actually. We've seen in a number of these trials where we've combined standard chemotherapy with immunotherapy, both in small cell as well as non-small cell. And I think the take-home message here is that adding immunotherapy to standard chemo doesn't change the toxicity profile of the chemotherapy, and adding chemotherapy to the immunotherapy doesn't change the toxicity profile of the immunotherapy. Because you're using more drugs, and these drugs are different, the cytotoxic chemo is different than the immunotherapy, you're at risk of seeing more side effects. But in MPOWER 133, there were no surprises in terms of what you would have expected anyway. There were the typical rate of immune-related adverse events, nothing unusual about them. They were no different than we've seen in multiple other trials with atezolizumab. And the atezolizumab didn't alter the typical chemotherapy-related toxicity that we see with platinum etoposide in this population. So I have no concerns about the triplet regimen in this setting based on safety.
So, Dr. Sosinski, what are the overall implications of MPOWER 133 for clinical practice?
The implications of 133 really was the first trial that really transitioned the standard of care to a new standard of care, and that was incorporation of atezolizumab with platinum-based therapy. And also including maintenance therapy. We've not had any successful maintenance trials in small cell lung cancer. In this trial did have maintenance atezolizumab in part of its design. So I think that this was the first positive trial, the first indication by the FDA, and really did change the standard of care and changed practice and changed expectations for extensive stage small cell lung cancer patients, that we knew that there was a significant number of patients that were going to receive benefit by the addition of atezolizumab without really subjecting them to any significantly increased risk of toxicity shown in the MPOWER 133 trial.
Okay, and so how will you incorporate atezolizumab into your treatment planning?
It's really been kind of my standard of care since the results of MPOWER 133 were released. I've been using it. It's been part of our pathway. As I mentioned before, it's part of the NCCN guidelines. And so that's kind of been my standard go-to treatment since the initial approval a couple of years ago.
Okay. And have you had experience with this regimen in your patients with extensive stage small cell lung cancer? And if so, what has your experience been?
Yeah, so it's significant experience. You know, we've used it in pretty much all the patients that we've seen that don't have a contraindication, which is not very many patients. I think that the incorporation of atezolizumab in this population has been relatively easy to do. I don't see any excessive toxicity. Patients are accepting of it. Patients like the idea of adding immunotherapy in this particular setting. As I mentioned before, we've not had any surprises with regard to toxicity. And so the approval kind of paved the way for practitioners to be using this on a routine basis. And that's what we've been doing. And You know, it's hard to know exactly the impact, but, you know, from the phase three data, you know, I do think that our patients are benefiting from this. And I do think that this is the new standard of care in this setting.
Right. And so I know we talked about the clinical implications, but what would you say are the implications of this approval for patients?
Well, to know that we can say we have a better therapy. You know, for years, we've been kind of stuck in the platinum doublet with etoposide kind of mode. And you know, frankly, there's nothing terribly exciting about that. And it's kind of been difficult for patients, because patients hear about new therapies, targeted therapies, immunotherapy, and they want that to be part of their treatment because they perceive it as being a positive thing. And now, you know, initially based on 133, we could say to patients, yes, adding immunotherapy to your regimen does offer you the chance of better overall outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So looking ahead, what do you see happening in the future in terms of immunotherapy and small cell lung cancer?
You know, it's trying to, I think hopefully what I would hope we could do is to figure out who's benefiting from the current approaches, who needs a different approach, what are the new approaches we need in those patients that don't seem to be benefiting as significantly as we would like them to. With the current standard of care. So what are the new IO strategies that are coming along? And then can we do better? You know, we talked a little bit earlier about biomarkers. Can we do better at identifying patients who are going to get great benefit from, in this case, an anti-PD-L1 drug, and also find those patients who might not be getting great benefit in this setting. So that's what I'm hoping for the future, as well as, just developing more active agents in this setting.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
That's all we have for today. Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology Peer Review on the Go podcast is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you again next time.